Thank you so much. And it's definitely fun to be back and to be seeing people who I'm beginning to recognize on the screen, which is nice. So this week and next, we're going to look at some books that we might have expected would have made it into the Bible, into the Tanakh, but definitely didn't. And in some ways, it's quite surprising that at least one of them didn't make it in order that we would have a biblical text that was associated with Hanukkah, so that we could read it on the festival or at least study it in association with the festival. And apart from recent new Chagim like Yom HaTzmaut and Yom HaShoah and so on, it really is the only festival we have that doesn't have an associated biblical text. That's unusual. So during these two sessions, we're going to sample and assess the four books of the Maccabees, which are our prime candidates. And we're going to try to unravel that, why none of them made the final cut. And of course, also to find out what they tell us about Hanukkah. And at the end of the second session, we will look more closely at the reasons why these books did not get into the Tanakh. Now, two of the four books form part of a much wider group of Jewish works that were written during the Hellenistic period, but were only preserved in the Christian world. And this wider group is known as the Apocrypha. And I'm going to show you a list of the Apocrypha. Here we are. This is what's in the Apocrypha. They all were written by Jews. They are pre-Christian books, but for reasons, for many different reasons, they didn't get into the Tanakh. Jews tended to forget about them, and they've been preserved in Greek. Some of them were originally written in Hebrew, though not all. Now, the Apocrypha, the name actually means the hidden books or the hidden things, and it's often understood as the equivalent of the Jewish term Sfarim Chitzonim, or external books, which is a category we often find in rabbinic literature. Well, we don't actually know whether Sfarim Chitzonim is the same as the Christian Apocrypha. There might be overlap, there might not. We honestly really don't know. And it could have been a term to mean anything that wasn't in Tanakh. Not absolutely sure about that. So, as you can see down the bottom, I've put them in bold. One Maccabees and two Maccabees are the books we're going to be interested in. I won't talk about any of the others. Might just mention Ecclesiasticus, nothing to do with Ecclesiastes. We call this Ben Sirach or Bin Sirach. So that might just turn up for half a moment. So there are two books of the Maccabees in the Apocrypha. They're collected in that group. But there are actually four of them altogether. There are two that didn't make it into the Apocrypha. They're just floating around, not in a group. And we will look at all four in these two sessions. Although Maccabees 3 and 4 are not part of the Apocrypha, they are genuine Jewish books from this period, and they are worth investigating. Books 1 and 2 describe the revolt of the Jews led by the Hasmonean family against the Seleucid kings, or as we've simplified it, the Greek kings, in the 2nd century BCE. And that's the sequence of events that we commemorate at Hanukkah. Book 3, which we'll touch on lightly, is a completely different story about the Jews of Egypt. And book 4 is a sort of theological or philosophical treatment of the Hanukkah story. So we'll consider them all, we'll sample them all to learn what they tell us or don't tell us in some cases about Hanukkah. And we will start off with 1 Maccabees. So we only have this book in Greek. Because it survived in the Apocrypha and preserved by the church. But we do know it was originally written in Hebrew and in a sort of biblical style at that. And you might say, how could you know such a thing? But we can because you can translate the Greek back into the Hebrew. Some of the idioms of biblical Hebrew, things like he found grace in her eyes, have been translated word for word into Greek. They're not natural Greek idioms. So you can see there's a Hebrew underlay to what we have now. Our earliest copies appear in the great big biblical books, again, Christian biblical books in Greek, the 4th century Codex Sinaiticus, which is the most fabulous two-volume, enormous, enormous Greek language copy of the Bible, including what we think of the Bible and also the New Testament. And if you're lucky enough, as I am, to live 3 miles away from the British Library, you can go down and see that because it's on permanent display. The other early copy, also in the British Library, is the Codex Alexandrinus, and they both have the first copies that we know of the Book of Maccabees. We don't have any older manuscripts, but it is an older book. We don't know anything about who wrote the first Book of Maccabees, but we know that the author was a supporter of the Hasmoneans. He was a big fan, and he lived in the land of Israel. He's very familiar with the geography. He knows where everything is. It's a place that he you know, has visited and lives in and knows. And it presents as a historical book, an account of the years from 175 BCE, when the bad king Antiochus IV Epiphanes came to the throne as leader and head of the Seleucid Empire, of which I have to say our part of the world was a very, very tiny amount. It went all the way to what is now Iraq and Turkey and so on. So the land of Israel was just a very minor province in this, but a strategically important one, because the rival empire, the Ptolemaic Empire, was in Egypt. And of course, as always, we're on that fault line between the two empires or the two superpowers. So the history presents from when Antiochus comes to the throne, through the story of the revolt of the Jews against religious persecution, the rise of the Hasmonean family and their leading of the revolt, the recapture and the cleansing and actually part rebuilding of the temple, right down to the death of Shimon the Maccabee or Simon the Maccabee in the year 134 BCE. This is all BCE, so the years go backwards. So it's a period of 40 years it covers. And it is our main and sometimes our only source for the events of the Hanukkah story. We don't actually have any other contemporary account at all, or semi-contemporary. But it is very hard for that reason to check just how accurate it is in historical terms, because we don't have any material we can check it against. And it clearly is written by somebody with a pro-Hasmonean agenda. This is not a neutral history book. And it's another question whether history can ever be neutral. You know, it's very famously said history is written by the victors, and that is always true. But here it's, you know, it's out loud and proud. This bloke thought that the Hasmoneans were a good thing. So it will be fascinating to have a history of this period written from an anti-Hasmonean view, but we haven't got it. The other historian who lived fairly close to this time is, of course, Flavius Josephus, and he lived actually through the destruction of the Second Temple in 70 CE and wrote our best account of that whole war. But he also wrote about earlier Jewish history. He wrote his two major works are The Jewish War, which are about events of his time, and Jewish Antiquities, which goes right back to the creation of the world and follows the story, the whole biblical story, and then comes up to his own day. So he used the first Book of Maccabees as his principal source. So unfortunately, we can't actually check Maccabees against Josephus, because Josephus got all his stuff out of Maccabees. So he's not a check on the historical accuracy at all of the first Book of Maccabees. What else can we say about the author? He was obviously a very religious person. He sees the course of history as controlled by God, which is a good, you know, good Jewish point of view. That's what the biblical books of history also understand. And he sees the Hasmonean family as divinely chosen to save the Jewish people. And he actually describes them as the family of those men through whom deliverance was given to Israel. So that's just a little rough bit of background. And you might say, well, that all sounds okay. I wouldn't mind that being in the Bible. You know, this sounds like the sort of thing we might want to read in Shul at Hanukkah. Why don't we? Okay. So let's knuckle down and look a little bit more closely. I might also mention that the author is not very interested in miracles. It does present like a history book, even if it isn't close history. And also he lived roughly during the events, we think. It must have been written after 134 BCE, because that's where the book ends. But it must have been written before 63 BCE, because that's when the Romans invade. And the author of this book is quite pro-Roman. He doesn't have any axe to grind with the Romans. So therefore, the sort of the narrow, most you can narrow it down is somewhere in the late 2nd to early 1st centuries BCE. So we've got about 100 years, a bit less than 100 years, maybe 80 years during which it could have been written. But that's quite close to the historical events. And also because it's our main source for Hanukkah, the first book of Maccabees has been very influential on Judaism, in an indirect way, I have to add, because Jews didn't really read it till the modern period. They got most of their information through Hebrew summaries or reworkings of parts of it, but not the book directly, because it was in Greek and it was associated with Christians. The book as a whole is only 16 chapters long, and it falls into three parts. First of all, Judaism is threatened by King Antiochus. We have the story of Matityahu, Mattathias' heroic response, and the section ends with his death in 166-165 BCE is really roughly when it covers, because 165 is when Mattathias dies. Then we have section two, the deeds of Mattathias' son Judas, or Judah the Maccabee, Yehuda, who recaptures the temple, and this section ends with his death in 160 BCE, and then from chapter 9 to the end is the deeds of his brothers, Jonathan, Simon, Jonathan and Shimon, ending with the death of Simon in 135 BCE. So roughly that's what it covers. And we are going to sample a bit from pretty near the beginning of the story, because this is the story we all know from Hanukkah. This is the original account, even if we don't actually read it in Shul. Okay, and I'd ask you to notice things about the style, things about what's included, what isn't, what your impressions are, and maybe if you put those reactions in the chat, we can discuss that when we finish reading this little extract. So here goes. In those days, Mattathias, the son of John, son of Simeon, a priest of the sons of Joarib, moved from Jerusalem and settled in Modi'in. He had five sons, John, surnamed Gadi, Simon, called Thassi, Judas, called Maccabeus, Elazar, called Avaran, and Jonathan, called Apphus. He saw the blasphemies being committed in Judah and Jerusalem and said, "Alas, why was I born to see this, the ruin of my people, the ruin of the holy city, and to dwell there when it was given over to the enemy, the sanctuary given over to aliens? Her temple has become like a man without honor. Her glorious vessels have been carried into captivity. Her babes have been killed in her streets, her youths by the sword of the foe. What nation has not inherited her palaces and has not seized her spoils? All her adornment has been taken away. No longer free, she has become a slave. And behold, our holy place, our beauty and our glory have been laid waste. The Gentiles have profaned it. Why should we live any longer?" And Mattathias and his sons rent their clothes, put on sackcloth and mourned greatly. Then the king's officers who were enforcing the apostasy came to the city of Modi'in to make them offer sacrifice. Many from Israel came to them, and Mattathias and his sons were assembled. Then the king's officers spoke to Mattathias as follows: "You are a leader, honored and great in this city, and supported by sons and brothers. Now be the first to come and do what the king commands, as all the Gentiles and the men of Judah and those that are left in Jerusalem have done. Then you and your sons will be numbered among the friends of the king, and you and your sons will be honored with silver and gold and many gifts." But Mattathias answered and said in a loud voice, "Even if all the nations that live under the rule of the king obey him and have chosen to do his commandments, departing each one from the religion of his fathers, that I and my sons and my brothers will live by the covenant of our fathers. Far be it from us to desert the law and the ordinances. We will not obey the king's words by turning aside from our religion to the right hand or to the left." When he had finished speaking these words, a Jew came forward in the sight of all to offer sacrifice upon the altar in Modi'in, according to the king's command. When Mattathias saw it, he burned with zeal and his heart was stirred. He gave right vent to righteous anger. He ran and killed him upon the altar. At the same time, he killed the king's officer who was forcing them to sacrifice, and he tore down the altar. Thus he burned with zeal for the law, as Pinchas did against Zimri, the son of Salu. And Mattathias cried out in the city with a loud voice, saying, "Let everyone who is zealous for the Lord supports the covenant come out with me." And he and his sons fled to the hills and left all that they had in the city. Then many who were seeking righteousness and justice went down to the wilderness to dwell there, they, their sons, their wives, and their cattle, because evils pressed heavily upon them. So let's have a look in the chat and see what sort of reactions you've had to this interesting bit. The sons all seem to have secular names. I'm not sure. Shimon isn't a secular name. John is Yochanan. Just looking at the beginning of the sons.
But they have other names attached to them.
Oh, those are nicknames.
Yeah, the nicknames.
They have nicknames. Yes. So Maccabee means hammer. Judah the hammer. They've all got nicknames. Yeah, definitely. Reads like Lamentations. Very good point, especially the first bit: the ruin of my people, the ruin of the holy city. Clearly, the author is very familiar with Tanakh and is using Tanakh models of language and imagery very, very clearly all the way through. So there's a great chunks that you could put right back into Echa and you wouldn't even notice that they weren't Echa. So exactly. So two people have pointed that out. Shades of Pinchas, yes, and you note that Pinchas is actually mentioned, really to drive the point home. Pinchas is a good person. Pinchas kills somebody without due legal process, but it's all okay. And he's a priest. This is a priestly family. And in a way, this is a license for Matityahu to kill somebody without any due process. He is acting like Pinchas's ancestor did. Therefore, it's okay, and God is going to approve of this. The rabbis were indeed incredibly ambivalent about Pinchas, because Pinchas is quite dangerous for rabbinic control and rule. You don't want people going, "Well, God has told me I'm doing the right thing. I'm going to kill this person because they're bad." That's the last thing you want in a society, really. It's horribly dangerous. So yes, they were very, very ambivalent. And this is why, for instance, you get Midrashim, like the very famous one about the Brit Shalom that God makes with Pinchas. It's noted that in the way the Torah scroll is written, there is a little break in the Vav of Shalom. And midrashically, some people understand that to mean it wasn't a perfect covenant. It wasn't perfect peace. It was a sort of, okay, post factum, I will let you have done this thing, but please, people, don't go off killing people on your own say-so without going through due process. So the rabbis are very ambivalent indeed. This author is not at all ambivalent. You can see that this author thinks it's a good thing. Zealous for the law sounds like Elijah. Yes, and again, we remember in Midrash, Pinchas and Elijah are constantly connected. And sometimes there are interpretations that Elijah is a reincarnation almost of Pinchas. So it's very much that theme. The five Greek nicknames. Well, I know that Maccabeus is hammer. I honestly don't know the others. It's not even clear to me if they're probably derived from Hebrew, I would say, because they look most un Greek. Gadi, Thassi, Avaran, and Aphis. I have no idea. You'd have to reconstruct the Hebrew or the Aramaic that lies behind each of these. I'm sure somebody has done that, but I'm afraid I'm not up to it. It's not something I looked at. But I'm sure if you look that up somewhere, could even be on Wikipedia for all I know, somebody will have explained what those names mean. Does that tell us they have special status, or is it just that everybody at this point had nicknames? You can imagine in a society where, you know, 25% of people were called Yochanan and 25% of people called Shimon, and it's quite a restricted group of names you get at this period, that they have distinguishing nicknames to, so you know which one is which. So it could be as banal and everyday as that. Or it could be that these are well-known people and they've all attracted a special title. I'm not sure if you can tell that from the book at all. Nearest text, New Testament, you do get people with nicknames who share the same name. There'll be person this and person that. So, for instance, Jesus's disciple Peter is actually called Simon, but it becomes a nickname, a distinguishing name for him to tell which Simon you're talking about. So it seems to have been something that was happening around about these times. I just couldn't tell if it's got further significance. What about the style? Anyone got any observations about the style of this and what it resembles? Can you imagine reading this in shul? granted, you know, in Hebrew.
It sounds a little bit like the New Testament, in, you know, the Christian Testament. It has that feel.
A little bit. Again, the New Testament is written in Greek.
It sounds a bit like Ruth.
No, like that's interesting. Can you isolate where it sounds where it sounds like Ruth?
It's like a story of going. It's like a history, a story of what was going on at the time. Also, the fact that the people are straying, beginning to stray, or at least some of them, and you know. And this is like the opposite. The leaders were in Ruth were going away from Beit Lechem, whereas here they're standing up. But the style seems to be, to me, it reads like Ruth.
I think you're mixing a little bit of Midrash there about Elchanan being a leader, because actually the Bible doesn't tell us at all.
No, but it seems.
Ruth is very much on an everyday plane. This is all going to be quite noble. This is about, you know, people attacking kings. So it's a little bit different. There's a lot more talking. There's a lot more dialogue here. There are long, long speeches. And that, I would say, is the main difference from most biblical writing. Yes, you have speeches of the prophets. So in that sense, it's a little bit like the prophets, or certainly like Echa. But you don't usually have long rhetorical devices. In fact, biblical conversations are quite basic. You know, people tell each other what they need to, but they don't have long flourishes. So things like, all her adornment has been taken away, no longer free, she has become a slave. You wouldn't find anyone saying that in Tanakh. Echa, yes, because that's songs of lament. But I don't think that would come into a biblical conversation. Now, this seems to be a convention of Greek writing. You have lots and lots of imagined rhetorical speeches that actually obey the rules of Greek rhetoric. And you get that in Josephus all over the place, you know, all sorts of occasions where people couldn't have been there. Speeches are put into their mouths. I mean, I doubt very much that in the middle of all this, somebody was writing down what Matityahu said. So this is sort of basically the internal monologue of Matityahu as imagined by the author. So imaginary reconstructed speeches, very much a feature of Greek literature, very much not a feature of most narrative in the Bible. So, well, somebody's looked up Gadi, which means my goat. Might mean he was particularly agile. Well, I suppose we go with Gadi, goat, indeed. Like later prophets, again, I think that's the sort of ranty bit that is Echa-like, which definitely is modelled on that. That's really, really true. And Sima Epstein's point, Mimesis makes that point. I take it you mean the book Mimesis. More like Greek writing with huge detail. Yes. And very good point. And Akiteti Yitzchak is actually 21 verses long, I think, if I've got that number right. Which is very short for a giant, giant story. It's a sort of an epic, but it's compressed and we have to do all the unpacking. There is no unpacking to do in much of 1 Maccabees, because it's already been unpacked for you at horrendous length sometimes. This one's quite short, actually, all the speeches. Yeah, sometimes they go on for, you know, pages. And the other books of the Maccabees, you sometimes get chapters, literally whole chapters that are one speech of somebody. A couple of other biblical echoes, Matthias crying out, saying, let everyone who's zealous for the law and supports the covenant come out with me, echoes Moses a bit after the golden calf, you know, Mil Hashem Elai. When he summons all the Levites. So we do have a lot of biblical echoes, but we don't have, but apart from the Echa-like part, we don't have a lot of biblical style. It's very much more Greek. If we have a quick look at some of the related biblical sources, you can see, and I won't keep pointing this out, but you'll see it in other sections too. So here's our bit from Bamidbar with Pinchas. I'm not going to read the whole thing, but the end bit is the relevant bit for this. Then an Israelite man brought into the camp a Midianite woman right before the eyes of Moses and the whole assembly of Israel while they were weeping at the entrance to the tent of meeting. When Pinchas, son of Eleazar, the son of Aaron, the priest, saw this, he left the assembly, took a spear in his hand and followed the Israelite into the tent. He drove the spear into both of them, right through the Israelite man and into the woman's stomach. then the plague against the Israelites was stopped. So again, this action on behalf of God, but unauthorized by humans, is definitely, that's what the author wants to bring out by quoting Pinchas. And you have the result. The Lord says to Moses, Pinchas, the son of Eleazar, son of Aaron, the priest, has turned my anger away from the Israelites. Since he was as zealous for my honor among them as I am, I did not put an end to them in my zeal. Therefore, tell him I'm making my covenant of peace with him. This is the peace where there is that break in the vow. He and his descendants will have a covenant of a lasting priesthood because he was zealous for the honor of his God and made atonement for the Israelites. So the author may also be implying that descendants of Pinchas, i.e. priests, have a license to do this stuff. So that might be a little bit of an apologetic there. And there I put the quote from Shemot about Mi Lashem Elai, whoever is for the Lord, come to me, and the rallying. Okay, so we do have these biblical undertones, but a sort of a Greek way of writing. We also have very black and white characterization. All the Gentiles are bad. All the Jews are good, except for the Jews who go over to the Gentiles who are bad. So there are no shades of gray here at all. It's very clear who's on which side. You don't have ambiguous characters. And again, if we ignore Midrash and we just look at the biblical text, you have people like Esau, who's a bit of an ambiguous character. Yaakov is quite an ambiguous character. Again, if you stay away from commentators and the Midrash. So this exploration of nuance and hidden motives is not in this at all. This is just plonk. What you see is what you get, very much, very different. So, we said that it recovers 40 years of history. We said it presents itself as history, but it can't be checked. But it's, there are also some other points where it really is a little bit wobbly, because the second book of Maccabees goes over some of the same ground and sometimes gives different dates. So that rather destabilizes this as an absolutely secure historical source. It's not really 100% clear. Was the whole story as simple as this? That, you know, the Jews were oppressed and they were told they couldn't practice their religion, and attempts were made to force them to practice pagan rites. And so they righteously rose up. There have been some modern questionings of this. So the Israeli scholar Sylvie Honigman has come up with a different analysis. She's looked more at Second Maccabees, and she suggests that it was all sparked off by an increase in taxes, you know, and the king meddling in the appointment of the high priest, which is something that went on, you know, the centuries, the Romans did it too. And she thinks that really is what sparked the revolt of. And interestingly, the bad king Antiochus was in the middle of his first or second campaign to invade Egypt. So it was a ticklish time for him, a time at which he was exposed and a bit vulnerable from behind. And that would have been a very good time to start a revolt. The king did react violently to suppress the uprising, but Sylvie Honigman suggests that there's no real evidence of a Hellenistic campaign to squash Judaism. That just probably didn't happen. However, we have to say, why that really happened in history, which we probably will never know, is a bit of a side question, because that's not the way the book has been understood. And that is not actually the way it's been influential in Judaism as a religion since. Since Jews have always regarded this basic story as a faithful historical account, that has shaped the way in which we interpret the Maccabean revolt as a quest for religious freedom to practice Judaism. And of course, another very interesting part of the book is the actual Hanukkah event, the rededication of the temple. So I think we should really read that, because that's one of the central parts of the book. Okay, so then Judas and his brother said, see, our enemies have crushed. We've missed out the crushing, but I assure they have by this time. Let us go up to cleanse the sanctuary and dedicate it. So all the army assembled and went up to Mount Zion. Interestingly, they call it Mount Zion because, as we know, Har Zion is actually a slightly different place from where the temple is, but okay. There they saw the sanctuary desolate, the altar profaned, and the gates burned. In the courts, they saw bushes sprung up as in a thicket or as on one of the mountains. They saw also the chambers of the priests in ruins. They tore their clothes and mourned with great lamentation. They sprinkled themselves with ashes and fell face down on the ground. And when the signal was given with the trumpets, they cried out to heaven. Then Judas detailed men to fight against those in the citadel until he had cleansed the sanctuary. There was at this period a fortress, the Ankara, that looked over and actually topped the temple, and you could shoot from the Ankara, you could shoot arrows and things into the temple. So obviously you have to flush the enemy out of there to make the temple secure. He chose blameless priests devoted to the law, and they cleansed the sanctuary and removed the defiled stones to an unclean place. They deliberated what to do about the altar of burnt offering, which had been profaned by having trade sacrifices offered to non-Jewish gods on it. And they thought it best to tear it down so that it would not be a lasting shame to them that the Gentiles had defiled it. So they tore down the altar and stored the stones in a convenient place on the temple hill until a prophet should come to tell what to do with them. Fascinatingly, we don't know what happened to those stones. They're never mentioned again. Then they took unhewn stones, as the law directs, and built a new altar like the former one. They also rebuilt the sanctuary in the interior of the temple and consecrated the courts. They made new holy vessels and brought the lampstand, the menorah, the altar of incense, and the table for the showbread into the temple. This is quite interesting, because from what we know, the Second Temple didn't have any of those things because they had been taken away by the Babylonians, and we don't actually know if they were fully replaced on the Second Temple. Oops, could everyone mute themselves? Thanks. They also they offered incense on the altar and lit lamps on the lampstand, and these gave light in the temple. They placed the bread on the table and hung up the curtains that screen off the Kodesh Kodeshim. Thus, they finished all the work they had undertaken. Little echo there of the finishing of the making of the tabernacle back in the Torah. Early on the morning of the 25th day of the ninth month, which is the month of Kislev, in the 148th year, not clear from what, they rose and offered sacrifice, as the Lord directs, on the new altar of burnt offering that they had built. At the very season and on the very day that the Gentiles had profaned it, so it must be a year at the very least after it's been captured, it was dedicated with songs and harps and lutes and cymbals. All the people fell on their faces and worshipped and blessed heaven who had prospered them. So they celebrated the dedication of the altar for 8 days and joyfully offered burnt offerings. They offered a sacrifice of well-being and a thanksgiving offering. They decorated the front of the temple with golden crowns and small shields. They restored the gates and the chambers for the priests and fitted them with doors. There was very great joy among the people, and the disgrace brought by the Gentiles was removed. And Judas and his brothers and all the assembly of Israel determined that every year at that season, the days of dedication of the altar should be observed with joy and gladness for 8 days. We might want to come back to that, beginning with the 25th day of the month of Kislev. What is the detail that is missing? What is
the oil. The pure oil that was there, that they found.
Yep, the little jug of oil. Yes, the katan. Okay, well, I have terrible news for you. This actually reduced my daughter to tears when I told her this one. That story doesn't appear till the Talmud. it doesn't appear till about 600 or 700 years after the events happened, which brings us back to, so why 8 days? Yeah, we all thought it was 8 days because of the katan. Yeah, right. Didn't we?
Right.
Okay. News for you. Apparently it wasn't. So the reason for the 8 days is probably this.
Sukkot.
This was actually a Sukkot celebration. Now, first of all, the timing is a little bit odd. The army of the general Lysias, whom Judah had been fighting, had withdrawn back in April. So why did they wait so long? Or was it, you know, doing the reparations? Not quite clear. Jonathan Goldstein, writing in the Anchor Bible series, suggests that Judah the Maccabee may have been waiting for the complete fall of Antiochus. He may have been waiting for the fulfillment of prophecies by the prophet Daniel that there would be further troubles and an earthquake, and then the downfall of King Antiochus and the end of his empire before the temple could possibly be dedicated. If we go back to Daniel chapter 7, which is a vision of four world empires that will be replaced by a fifth, they seem to refer to the Babylonians, the Medes, the Persians, and the Greeks. And interestingly, the details of the Greek period actually reflect the history of this period down to the year 167 BC, when they abruptly stop and go into fantasy, which gives you a good date for the possible writing of the book of Daniel. So here's Daniel 7. And you can see it's a bit vague, because that's what prophecy does. As for the 10 horns out of this kingdom, 10 kings shall arise and another shall arise after them. This one shall be different from the former ones and shall put down 3 kings. He shall speak words against the Most High, shall wear out the holy ones of the Most High, and shall attempt to change the sacred seasons and the law. And they shall be given into his power for a time, 2 times and half a time. Now you can calculate any date you want from a time, 2 times and half a time. Then the court shall sit in judgment, and his dominion shall be taken away to be consumed and totally destroyed. The kingship and the dominion of the greatness of the kingdoms under the whole heaven shall be given to the people of the holy ones of the Most High. That's us, obviously. Their kingdom shall be an everlasting kingdom, and all dominions shall serve and obey them. So it has been suggested that that's what Judah was waiting for. You know, okay, let that happen, and then we'll do the temple. That seems, you know, so it seems to be quite a reasonable supposition. Unfortunately, you know, nothing much was happening. In addition, we have another interesting possibility. At this point, the Jewish calendar was based on observation of the new moon. And nowadays, we do it by calculation of the new moon. And back in those days, you put in extra months when it was felt necessary, not according to a prescribed pattern, which is what we do now. So it's possible that one or two of the intercalary, the extra months, had been missed during all this period of warfare and revolt, because you couldn't have gone around proclaiming them throughout the country, you know, it's the middle of a war. So by this stage, it's suggested the calendar could have been out of whack a bit. It could have been moving backwards. Also, there is a rule you can't put in an extra month between Adar and Tishrei. So the Jews waited till Tishrei, which would have been sort of more around midsummer because of the months missing. Then they decided they better get on with the cleansing and rededicating the temple, because perhaps this was not when God was going to do it for them. So Sukkot would have been the first festival they could have celebrated in a cleaned up temple. They would have calculated Sukkot properly from the autumn equinox. But it fell in what was technically the uncorrected month of Kislev, even though it was the summer. So they said, right, 25th Kislev. But then when the calendar is restored and sort of adjusted back to its proper seasonal fixings, Kislev, of course, moves ahead to winter, which is why we are celebrating an 8-day festival based on Sukkot in Kislev. Because otherwise it will be very, very hard to explain why the book says it is 8 days. And in fact, it does actually call Hanukkah, the second book of Maccabees calls Hanukkah the days of Sukkot in the month of Kislev. So it could be that we're celebrating Hanukkah at the wrong time. And it's not actually a festival of light and darkness. It's a festival of light in the autumnal sphere of lengthening twilight. I don't know. But that's something that might give us pause. Fascinating possibility. Of course, again, we can't prove it, but that would explain why Sukkot turns up in this Kislev context here, because otherwise that's very, very puzzling indeed. Okay, so that's First Maccabees, and we'll come back to it in the second session and weigh up its potential. But yeah, you know, that so far it tells you what happens. I could see you might have to take extracts rather than read the whole 15-chapter book. Was it 16-chapter book in Shul? That could take a long time. But yeah, you can imagine reading bits from this, quite possibly, in Shul. Translated back in Hebrew, you might have to prune it a little bit, all that long Greek rhetoric. But yeah, you know, it would do the job. What about the second book of Maccabees? Okay, very different from the first. It's got much more of a feel of religious propaganda, not so much history, though it may have some real historical information as well. It was originally written in Greek. This one has no Hebrew, what's it called, Vorlage in German, the sort of underlying version. It's 15 chapters long, and it claims in its introduction to be an abridgment of a much, much longer work in 5 volumes written by a certain Jason of Cyrene. Now, Cyrene is North Africa, roughly where Libya is now. We don't know anything about Jason of Cyrene except his name pops up in this book. It only covers 15 years. It goes from it's still in the time of Judah the Maccabee. It goes up to his victory over the enemy general Nicanor in 164 BCE. So, okay, that's it's slightly less of a time span than you have in First Maccabees, but again, you know, it's covering some of the same ground. It's quite similar in its account to First Maccabees. There's sometimes events happen in a different order. First Maccabees is usually thought to be reliable, but not everyone would agree. The book starts off with two letters. If we look at the structure, we've got two letters to the Jews of Egypt, urging them to observe Hanukkah, plus a little preface by the author. Then we have the background of the Hasmonean revolt and lots of martyrdom stories. That's chapters 4 to 7. And then we have the story of the revolt between 166 and 164 BCE. So that's roughly what you get. The differences, what are the differences? It's much more elaborate Greek. So if you thought the first book of Maccabees was flowery, this is much more flowery. It's very elegant indeed. And the miracle stories are huge. They are really half the book or more, including the very, very famous story of the mother and her seven sons who all get martyred slowly, slowly, slowly. You know, all the sons get martyred first and then the mother gets martyred at the end. This struck the Jewish imagination and has appeared in many, many versions. It appears in the Midrash in Eicha Rabbah, where it's attributed to the time of the Babylonians and the destruction of the first temple. It appears here and it appears somewhere else, which I've totally forgotten. I think it's in the Talmud in Gittin. The woman has different names. Sometimes she's Hannah, sometimes she's Miriam. She's not named in Maccabees. Second Maccabees is the earliest of those three texts. There are lots of angels. There are lots of omens in the book. And a clear message runs through it. The nation's sin brings punishment, but the strength of the Jews lies in observing the commandments. That's a good, you know, middle of the road, major message of Judaism. Interestingly, it's the first place we see Judaism referred to as a cultural religion or a civilization, Judaismos, and it is opposed to Hellenism, which is either Allophilismos, an opposite way of life, or Hellenismos, the Greek way of life. So that abstract concept of us against them in terms of way of life and belief and civilization, this rather than just plain nationality, this really first comes up in Second Maccabees. The whole theme of martyrdom is enormous in Second Maccabees, and it does seem that this period, Maccabean period, and the literature from it is where our whole concepts of martyrdom come. They're not so clear in Tanakh or earlier on at all. And these things also had a huge afterlife, as you know. So the book asserts that keeping loyal to God's covenant with Israel leads to honor, abandoning Jewish ways leads to shame. And the bad characters who are Jewish but don't lead Jewish lives and abandon Judaism come to very sticky ends, and the author's very pleased about it. There's a lot of gloating at the bad ends of wicked people. The interesting thing also about what is the main point of Judaismos for this author, and they are, the three points are Brit Milah, Shabbat, and Kashrut, all things that emphasize the distinctive nature of Jews. And another praiseworthy act that's emphasized quite a bit is giving tzedakah. Nothing else much, you know, in practical Jewish terms actually turns up. So, the idea also connected with martyrdom of you get your reward in the next world, that was actually unknown in the Bible. The Bible doesn't talk about that. The Bible's very reticent and vague about the afterlife. It has a concept of Sheol, which is this dark, boring place that nothing ever happens in. And people go down there, good, bad, they all end up there, and it's dusty and boring and just, you know, the nothingness. But at this point, we have very lively ideas about good worlds to come and bad worlds to come. If you do good things in this world, like being a martyr, God will reward you and you'll have eternal life with him. So that's very much a new theme in Judaism of this period at all. So we're going to read a little bit of the famous mother and seven sons story. I have abbreviated it enormously because it goes on for miles and it sort of revels in all the gory details of execution. But this will give you a flavor of it. It happened also that seven brothers and their mother were arrested and were being compelled by the king under torture with whips and cords to partake of unlawful swine's flesh. One of them, acting as their spokesman, said, "What do you intend to ask and learn from us? For we are ready to die rather than transgress the laws of our fathers." In other words, if you're doing this as an interrogation, we have nothing to tell you. We're going to stay from. The king fell into a rage and gave orders that pans and cauldrons be heated. These were heated immediately. And she commanded that the tongue of their spokesman be cut out. And then I think there's a lot of detail. I thought, let's not put it in. The brothers and their mother encouraged one another to die nobly, saying, the Lord God is watching over us and in truth has compassion on us, as Moses declared in his song, which bore witness against the people to their faces when he said, and he will have compassion on his servants. And then we have details of the deaths of all the elder six brothers at extensive length. So I thought I'd spare and we'd get on to the youngest brother. The youngest brother being still alive, Antiochus not only appealed to him in words, but promised with oaths that he would make him rich and enviable if he would turn from the ways of his fathers. Since the young man would not listen to him at all, the king called the mother to him and urged her to advise the youth to save himself. After much urging on his part, she undertook to persuade her son. But leaning close to him, she spoke in their native tongue as follows, deriding the cruel tyrant. My son, have pity on me. I carried you 9 months in my womb and nursed you for 3 years and have reared you and brought you up to this point in your life and have taken care of you. I beseech you, my child, to look at the heaven and earth and see everything that is in them and recognize that God did not make them out of things that existed. Thus also mankind comes into being. Do not fear this butcher, but prove worthy of your brothers. Accept death, so that in God's mercy, I may get you back again with your brothers, i.e. in the afterlife. While she was still speaking, the young man said, what are you waiting for? I will not obey the king's command, but I obey the command of the law that was given to our fathers through Moses. But you, who have contrived all sorts of evil against the Hebrews, will certainly not escape the hands of God, for we are suffering because of our own sins. And if our living Lord is angry for a little while to rebuke and discipline us, he will again be reconciled with his own servants. But you, unholy wretch, you most defiled of all men, do not be elated in vain and puffed up by uncertain hopes when you raise your hand against the children of heaven. You have not yet escaped the judgment of the Almighty, all-seeing God. For our brothers, after enduring a brief suffering, have drunk of ever-flowing life under God's covenant. But you, by the judgment of God, will receive just punishment for your arrogance. I, like my brothers, give up body and life for the laws of our fathers, appealing to God to show mercy soon to our nation, and by afflictions and plagues to make you confess that he alone is God, and through me and my brothers to bring to an end the wrath of the Almighty, which has justly fallen on our whole nation. The king fell into a rage and handled him worse than the others, being exasperated at his scorn. So he died in his integrity, putting his whole trust in the Lord. Last of all, the mother died after her sons. Let this be enough then about the eating of sacrifices and the extreme tortures, which is a bit ingenuous because he goes on for pages after that. So you get the idea. And again, this is real Greek rhetoric because, you know, it's inconceivable that a foreign king saying either eat the pig or I'm going to chop your head off is going to sit around while people insult him. You know, this clearly didn't happen. Also, nobody was there writing it all down. So this is what was expected in Greek history. I mean, it's not a fake. That's how history was written then. You put into the mouths of your characters what they should have said at that juncture to explain their motives. It's a very good example of it. It is a bit over the top. I think for modern tastes, less is more when you've had, you know, that was the seventh son. There've been six of them already. So it is in a way, propaganda. And I don't say that in a bad sense. It's very clearly saying, if you give up your life for the sake of God, God will reward you in the next life. And it's a good thing to do. And that is what God expects you to do. And bad people will be punished in the next world, which of course is a foundation of many people's belief when this is also the medieval Jews, when the Crusaders tried to kill them or convert their kids. This is exactly what they were thinking about, these ideas. So we see the evolution of an idea, if you like, a doctrine of being a martyr that develops about this time. And this is then, by the way, inherited by Christians a couple of hundred years later. It was already in Judaism, and Christians draw on this tradition to develop their own set of martyrs and their own ideas about what being a martyr means. So again, it's very, very important. You could see why this might not be such a good candidate for reading in short, possibly. It really, really sounds Greek, very Greek indeed. So let's have a little look and see what people have said in the chat. Just going backwards. Where are we? Oh, backwards. Oh, my heavens. Right. We learn about the Babylonian conquest and the Roman conquest. What about the Greeks? When did this Greek control of Israel take place? Well, it wasn't really the Greeks. It was the Seleucids. So this is, as we said, you know, that it can be traced to 167 BCE, is the uprising. That's the usual date that most people accept. So 2nd century BCE. And the Seleucid Empire, it was one of the succession empires after Alexander the Great. Alexander the Great died in 323. And his generals carved up his empire between them. Ptolemy was the general who took Egypt and started off the Ptolemaic dynasty. It's all very easy there. It's Ptolemy I, Ptolemy II, Ptolemy III, Ptolemy IV, etc. Seleucus took the rest of the empire, which was Turkey, sort of part of the world, Iraq, Iran, what have you, and started the Seleucid dynasty, and they had different names. And the king who is the king at this point is Antiochus IV Epiphanes. So we call them the Greeks. They weren't Greeks at all. They were they were a multinational empire, actually, the Seleucid Empire, with people of Macedonian descent controlling them. And they all shared in the same Hellenistic culture, which was all the way around the Mediterranean, right down to Egypt. A lot of Jews were sharing it too, as you can tell from the books of the Maccabees, which are written in Greek by Jews, deploring how wicked the Greeks are. So when we say Greek, it's shorthand for Seleucids. Okay, if the theme is all Gentiles are bad, has this become part of Christian tradition? It was a preserved book, and it's sort of interpreted, the bits that Christians take out of it are it's good to be martyred for your faith. And here are faithful Israelites before Jesus turns up doing what we must do now. Gentiles now becomes people who don't agree with Christianity. You just change the reference and it becomes part of your tradition. Yeah, they weren't Christians then. Yep, people have put on Alexander. Yep, excellent. Yes, no miracles, sorry about that. Was not the temple supposed to be dedicated originally on Sukkot? I think so. First temple, is that around? I think it gets dedicated around Sukkot, doesn't it? I can't remember. Somebody here will correct me on that. A temporarily moved Sukkot celebration since they hadn't been able to celebrate Sukkot on time. Yes, that seems to be the major motivation for modeling on Sukkot. And Morris has written both temples were dedicated in Kislev. It probably says in the Book of Kings, doesn't it? I'm not sure. I'm not up on the Book of Kings. Maybe to conform to many light festivals in different cultures with the winter solstice. Well, that's certainly one reason why it was a success. Yeah. Some festivals take and some don't. Note the appeal at the beginning of 2 Maccabees saying to the Egyptian Jews, please, will you observe this festival? We're all doing it back home. You should be doing it too. So clearly it takes a while, and later festivals, Yom Kippur is one thing, it says so in the Torah, but other things don't always catch on. In our own day, Yom HaShoah is not universally observed by Jews. And there are sections of the Jewish community that don't observe Yom HaShoah and don't observe Yom HaAtzmaut either. So if there was no Pachshim and no need to eat so many latkes, right? Well, you can't undo Jewish tradition by waving history at it, really. It's the reception of the book, the way we've used it, the way we've understood it, and the meanings we've constructed out of it are, at the bottom line, actually more important than what happened in history, which we'll never know, because we don't have the materials to know that. So our interpretations, including the Talmud's charming story of the little jug of oil, you know, don't throw those traditions away. They're still very, very important. Judaism is a long-lived civilization. And if some of the things it builds on are slightly less than factually true, it doesn't matter, they've become culturally true. So I would not worry about it. Latkes are much more recent. Indeed, potatoes are from the New World. I don't know if they were pre potato latkes, but they're carrot latkes. Don't know. 7th, 9th, 1st, 7th. Yes, absolutely. That's because of the shift from the Julian calendar to the Gregorian, I think. Still need to explain how the holiday lasted as an 8-day festival. New research claims Kislev is the olive harvest. Good God. Olive harvest these days is sort of October in Israel, so I don't know. Not sure. I'm not sure at all. And there's, well, yeah, 8 days because, you know, Sukkot plus Shmini Atzeret. I'm presuming that's why 8 days. And then, you know, somebody, the time of the Talmud comes up with this lovely thing about the Pashrimites, it will prop it up a bit. Solomon 8-day temple, yeah, dedication of the tabernacle is, well, that's 12 days actually, isn't it? Because all the tribes come and make offerings. So, yep, people speculating about the 8 days. Yep. Sukkot and all success, yes. Avadazara says Adam observed an 8-day holiday after the winter solstice, which holiday was adopted by the pagans. Again, that may be the Gemara making sense of something they see around them and going, yeah, obviously it's a universal thing, isn't it? Asher says 148 years is after the cannabis degree of minus 312 BCE. Yes, there are at least two dating systems used in the books of the Maccabees, by the way. One is this. I think one is the Seleucid era. There was a Seleucid era and Jews used that well into, in certainly Mishnaic times and possibly afterwards, because, our whole system we use now, for, you know, 5-7, et cetera, et cetera, that's quite late. That doesn't exist at this point. And if you look at archaeological evidence, you can see that Jews are using local dating systems, the year of the king or the Seleucid era or what have you. And so one of the problems with Maccabees is sorting out the dates because they're using two systems simultaneously, which is annoying, shall we say. Awfully long speech by the youngest brother. The king would never let him go on that length. Yes, and he's already sat through six speeches of equal length or longer by the first six brothers. So yes, this is a rhetorical device. By the Christians embrace this and Jews didn't. I don't know. I think we just definitely did embrace this. Can the excavation of the more probable origins and events of Hanukkah be incorporated into a refreshed and more complex celebration? Maybe, but I think people are very reluctant to lose legends they tell their kids and also luckers. So good luck with that. Maybe little bits could be added around the edges. Haggai says the construction of the second temple was the 24th day of the ninth month. Oh, so that would bring you back to, yeah. Okay, maybe. Ate a symbolic covenant. All these are really good suggestions. The answer is we don't know. We really, really, really don't know that at all. So we have all these wonderful possibilities and some of these comments are absolutely fantastic. And yes, it's fascinating to speculate exactly on what's going on here, or how exactly Hanukkah started in historical terms. I would say that, however, the actual events fell out, the fact that we have all these ideas probably reflects all sorts of ideas and possibilities and themes and things that are important to people at the time and later. And therefore, they actually do impact on the way Hanukkah settles down and develops. And that's just the way culture and religions do develop. It's not as though, you know, everything follows on from the historical event X, so we do Y. There's all sorts of interpretations, understandings and other themes and people thinking we could bring that in. It's a very complex process. And when you have a civilization as ancient and diverse as Judaism, you know, how much more so. But it is fascinating to think that maybe it's a little bit more complicated than we thought. And certainly in our quest to find why the books of the Maccabees weren't incorporated in the Bible, I think we've already seen some pointers, which are, A, these aren't all about the history. B, some of this is very Greek in style. And C, some of it is, and again, I say this not in a nasty way, some of this is propaganda. This is religious encouragement to people. That they can reuse at other times. And we know people did. And people did refer back to the heroes and the martyrs of the Hasmonean period in order to reinforce themselves when they were in similar circumstances. So they perform a function. It's just possibly that might not be a biblical function. But we'll talk more about that next time. So I think we've come to the end of our time. We've come to the end of the questions in the chat. So I look forward to seeing you again next week. And we will discuss Maccabees 3 and Maccabees 4, and then we'll try to thrash out the major factors about why they didn't end up in the Bible at the end of our little survey. So see you then.
All right. Thank you.
Most interesting. Thank you.
Thanks. Bye-bye,
everyone.
Look forward to seeing
you. Thank you.
Have a wonderful week. Everyone, all the best.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Thank you.